This is an open meeting of Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to may recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety and AA, our common welfare. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept things I cannot change,
the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Kaylee will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Kaylee, an alcoholic. I don't even know if I'm supposed to say that.
Sorry. Hi, Kaylee.
This is just making sure this was the right thing. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Kaylee. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. All of our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statement of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all our speakers to identify by first name only, and to please refrain from using profanity. Please help me welcome our first 10-minute speaker tonight, Joe.
Hello, everyone. Joe, alcoholic.
I am. Okay.
Alrighty. Hi, everybody in the computer world. A slouch, I guess. Joe, alcoholic. It's good to be outside my house during the week past 8 o'clock. I have an 18-month-old, so dad night's out, I guess. Back in Brookline. That's funny, I grew up West Roxbury, not too far away from here, and I went to school at BU, and I lived in Cleveland Circle many, many years ago, and so driving through, I'm just like, I got arrested there, dated a girl over there, got into a fight over there, went to my first AA meeting over there, so it's good, city meetings are great, it's not like the suburb meetings, different problems out there. Anyways, stay here as long as you can. Really. But let's see. I will do my best. not to swear. I will pray for me here. I think I got it now that I have a kid. It's a little bit better these days. So my sobriety date is October 12th, 2014. And, you know, a little bit about my background. I grew up another Irish-Italian kid here in Boston that's Catholic, altar boy, alcoholic family. That came with its kind of slew of issues and also a lot of fun stuff, too. So, you know, as I grew up being an only child, I think with divorced parents, I mean, I was the king, right? When you're the first son of an Italian family, you can do no wrong. You know, my father was an alcoholic. I grew up within an alcoholic home, but then my parents split and my dad ended up getting sober. But, you know, I still had, I guess you'd say, a lot of, like, buried trauma as a child. And as I started to get older, I definitely exhibited alcoholic behavior for sure. You know, I moved out to the burbs right when I was in high school, like kind of Northborough, Southborough. I don't know if you guys were familiar with there. It's on the other side of Framingham. So to me, I was like in a completely different world. And I was just joking. That's when I fell in love with lacrosse, marijuana, and the Grateful Dead. that's what they did out there. And, you know, it was a cool life. I had, from a material standpoint, a very secure life, but I had all of these, you know, traumas growing up, you know, again, in that alcoholic home. My dad was battling, you know, with his sobriety and recovery, and eventually got his stuff together, and him and I have a phenomenal relationship. But those behaviors, those, as they say in the big book, those, you know, causes and conditions kind of just festered. And I always had this thought that I was different, right? You know, I lived in a very affluent town, but kids didn't know what my life was like, right? Kids didn't know what my dad was like. Kids didn't know what it was like to grow up with a stepdad. And like, I just always had these ideas that, you know, for whatever reason, I was just this island. Right, and I tried my best to fit in, right, and I did fit in many, many aspects. And of course, you know, everyone knows high school. I mean, we're all going to try and just suffer through those 4 years of whatever that is, and then you're off and running to college, where you're just free to run around this area, and you know, get arrested by the New York Police Department, get arrested by the Brooklyn Police Department. I'm still banned from that police department. I went years later to pay. Because I had to, I popped a sprinkler while I was in a cell, and like I got sober, went through the steps, and I went to go get my $800. And one of the cops was just like, "Hey, we know you," and I was just like, "I'm here to pay mine." you know, and you know, I mean, that's what it was. But you know, I completely went rogue, I just let my alcoholism just completely took my life, right? I was, you know, I got through college, but like, you know, was burning friendships, burning, you know, intimate relationships. I you know, I could never show up to anything on time. Like, I was just busting at the seams. You know, then I got into drugs, and like that was just that next layer of, you know, just complete insanity. And I'm thankful for the harder drugs, because it brought me to my knees that much quicker. I mean, if I was anything like the Irish side of my family, I would have been able to keep drinking until now. We still have full-blown alcoholics, and they're highly functional. And you can see in my family the ones who quit drinking and how well they're doing, and the ones that aren't. So I had this moment. I woke up in a hospital. My girlfriend at the time, I was 24 years old, and my mom was there too, which was great. And, you know, my mom was just like, "Are you done? You know, are you done?" And I knew it was like, hey, you got the bug, kid. You know it's in the family. Are you going to do something about it? And I decided to, you know, at that point, I remember I just broke down crying and was just like, yeah, I want to do something. So anyways, I went to my first meeting. I ended up going to a men's big book step study meeting. It's actually where my dad went, and it's where all these quote-unquote uncles that I grew up with, that I figured out, was just like, hey, wait, that guy's here too. Hey, I know that guy too, right? Like, for me, my experience there was, and a lot of people don't have this experience, like, I somehow knew AA, and I knew these group of men that lived very happy lives, and they were having fun, and like, they didn't need to drink, and like, they just seemed normal to me. So I completely followed them, you know, out of blind faith. And they brought me through the process, and I was able to learn, you know, my character defects, right? My shortcomings, you know, resentments, fear, sex behavior. And I got to look at myself and understand that, yes, all of these things have had happened to me, but I could either continue to play that victim card and isolate and think I was different, or actually take some accountability and actually take some action. And the great thing is that these steps, you know, they don't end. They allowed me to look at myself with, you know, really a deep scope and some real deep reflection and see what I was like and what I could be. You know, then you go off and run, you start apologizing for stuff, which is always fun. But I was able to rectify all of that and then live on these new principles. And what did those principles, you know, do for me? I mean, I was able to get my job back, right? I was able to meet a girl that I'm now married to. Like, someone married me. Like, you know, I'm somebody's dad now, right? Like, and that happened rapid fire. And for me, you know, without fellowship, without these meetings, you know, I wouldn't have had any of that. And that's really what I wanted. For me, I just wanted to be, I wanted to be a dad. You know, I wanted to be a husband. I wanted to have a family. You know, I'm an only child, you know, so like I'm looking at my wife like, when are we going to have two and three? Like, I want little kids running around, you know, and that wasn't an option when I was active, right? Because I was so selfish and so driven by my disease that, you know, I just didn't know how to live life. And now I'm on the other side of that. And so now I use these steps to, you know, how do I stay a good husband, right? How do I stay a good employee? How do I stay and be a good father? And, you know, for me, if it wasn't for this program and it wasn't for these steps out of the Big Book and the men that brought me through it and led by example, I don't know where I'd be. You know, so I'm just, you know, I'm grateful. And when Brian asked me to come down today, he's just like, hey, man, give us 10 minutes of your story. You know, the alcoholic in me was like, sure, I love talking about myself. But at the same time, I think, you know, it will change your life. It changed my life. And again, I'm happy to talk to anybody after the meeting and share more of my experience. And again, I'm deeply grateful that you allowed me to speak here tonight. And I think I just got my 1 minute call. So thank you so much. Goodbye, people on the computer.
Thanks, Joe. We will now observe the seventh tradition. AA has no dues or fees for AA membership, but we do have a sense. Seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. There's a QR code in the basket if you want to do a Venmo also. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, we've asked Corey to read the 12 traditions.
Corey, alcoholic.
Hey, Corey.
These are our traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are for trusted servants. Three, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting AA groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never to endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Corey. Now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Bridget.
Hola, mi amores.
Hola.
I don't speak French. So my name is Bridget, and I'm an alcoholic. It is. Thank you, everybody. I'm so used to being on Zoom. No one says anything back, so I have no manners. Anyways, so thank you to Sarah and Megan for thinking of me and asking me to speak. I will try to enunciate. Anyways, so my sobriety date is... Joey, you're really tall. my sobriety date is September 24th. 2021. I have about 20 months, or almost 21 months. And when I came in here, I was not convinced that I was an alcoholic, but I was convinced that I wanted you all to teach me how to drink better. And I thought I was coming into charm school. And I remember the first woman I heard speaking about her day count. She was talking about how she hadn't drunk in 6 months, and I said, holy moly, I don't know. Of course, you know, I come from a big family, and I also have like alcoholics in my family. 16 people, not all alcoholic, just we're 16 in the family. And I used to think that that was why I was a drinker, but then all of you taught me that it's a matter that I passed the invisible line, and when I wanted to stop drinking, I couldn't stop. And the way I think about it now is I'm on this like diet, right? It's the alkaline diet. I can tell you about it after. But it's essentially I have to, you know, try and eat foods that are alkaline rich and not acidic. And one of the things that is really acidic is coffee. For the life of me, I cannot not drink coffee, especially when it's free. so I think about my disease the same way. It took me at least 3 tries to finally decide that I wanted to be in this program. And it was more on a cerebral level. So when I say cerebral, I mean like I saw what you all had and I wanted it. But I was still negotiating with myself how I could be in the program but still drink, you know, and still be sober. Really? and I had sobriety sisters, and around like 3 months into my sobriety, couple of my sobriety sisters had relapsed. And it was a turning point for me. And I think what's beautiful about it is all of you have told me that everything is a process. Even my surrender, the moon, this, like, everything is a process. It doesn't happen instantly. So when I got to that point where I felt myself having drinking signals on my birthday and trying to figure out why, because I thought I had just grasped that, you know, I want to be part of the no matter what club. Interestingly enough, I had also smoked some weed on my birthday, and my disease was telling me since I had done that, I might as well. And I had to really, really wrestle, because all of the times that I had tried to be sober, I was doing it with, like, I was doing it the buddy system, and I didn't realize I was still doing the buddy system with my sobriety sisters. Sort of like, oh, let's go to the gym. But if you mess up, I have an excuse to mess up too. And I found my disease telling me that exact thing. Like, since my sobriety sisters had relapsed, I might as well. And I remembered something so pivotal for me. It was like, the only requirement to be in this program is the desire to stop drinking. And that was it. I don't know why it clicked, but it did. Because I think originally I was like, oh, I didn't have a real, a bottom like so-and-so. You know, I'm still young. Or all of the different things that the mind comes up with. And when I decided that, it wasn't so much that I wanted to see how low I could go, but that I wanted to stop drinking, then that became the moment for me. And then I remember coming in as a thank you, divine. You all telling me about my needing to surrender. And I was having these struggles where I would pray in the morning and then I would take my power back. I came as a Catholic leader of my, church group, and I didn't know what you agnostics were talking about, but I had my ish together. But then I took a step series where the person who was running us through it asked us to write down our ideas about God. And I wrote this letter that was like 2 pages long, and it was resentment and a realization for me that I had been treating God like my butler and my secretary. And I was upset that they only did their job when I was, my back was against the wall. And even though I had phenomenal things happen for me, like coming to this country with all of my family and a lot of my siblings surviving death and all of these other things, I was upset that my life was not where I should be. It should be, and God was to blame. And that was a little, but what really helped was like being asked, was I willing to believe that because God gives me free will and other people free will, all of those things that I had experienced in my life were under a consequence of other people, including myself, standing in our free will. And I was like, yeah. So was I willing to believe that God was all of these things, gracious, forgiving, and I had to concur. And once I did, I was able to meet a God that I trusted. Once all of the mockery of my expectations and my illusions about what God was were, discarded. And it's really hard not to swear, Joe. So once I was able to meet a God that I trusted, I had to really work extra hard every day to stay in communion with our God and in trust with our God. And one of my sobriety fellows was telling me, it was a speaker who, I've had the opportunity to befriend because I started taking up a service which included finding speakers. He was like, Bridget, why don't you pray to God every morning for the willingness to trust them? I am Catholic, but I don't trust God, which I've learned it does not. Being religious is not the same as being trusting over God. And that was in itself freeing. And in that prayer, I found myself falling in love with other people's gods, or calling on to them, or saying prayers that when I first came in, I was just, oh, that's self-religious. So for example, this Native American prayer, the first time I heard it at the meeting that I go to on Sundays, I was like, this doesn't sit well with me. But I say that prayer a lot. I say that prayer a lot. And I feel like it helps me stay not only in communion with my, you know, the concept, the God of my understanding, but also in relation with the environment around me. I find myself saying things like, ancestors, help me, which also used to be something that I thought was sacrilegious. But you all have taught me that recovery, because there was so much came into, contributed to me getting here. It has to be a village, thank you, divine. It has to be a village that helps me. And I've acquired so many villages, and one of my friends calls them glam squad members, you know, glam with a double A, because, you know, AA, all of you, it works, you know? Because all of us help each other stay sober, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, you know, look good when I'm, you know, my mind wants to take me for a dog walk. And it does a lot. And this morning it was so interesting. I found myself praying, God, help me give up the pleasure of self-pity. Because all of you have also taught me that that's not where the power is. But I used to think it was. And then when I started to pay attention to my, you know, mind, I noticed that it was just making me think I had power. But I was in isolation and I was in pain. But thank you all for saving my life, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Bridget. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Ramiro. Right here. And now let's welcome our main speaker for the evening, Pat.
Thank you, Jeff. I saw Chad at a meeting earlier today. He's doing his business. It's very important. My name's Pat. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Pat.
I'm a member of the Berkeley Sunday Morning Group, 9:30 to 10:30, 921 Boylston Street in Boston. My sobriety date is the 4th of November, 1980. At that meeting that we were at today, the guy started off saying, I was born in 1980. I'm taking a look at it. But the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I could understand that young man right from the get-go. Because we're both alcoholics, and we were sharing our experience, strength, and hope. We weren't looking for a recording contract or anything else like that. And Boston is nice because speaking is usually short. We don't have the one-hour speakers. Usually it's about 15 minutes of the commitment. And if you look around, you won't find it in these quote-unquote CD tape things of AA speakers. You don't find many people from the Boston area. And I think that the 15, 20, 25 minutes keeps us right size. And so we're sharing our own experience, strength, and hope, not what you should do. And another thing I was thinking of, today is the longest day of the year, right? It's summer solstice. And I was at a meeting one time in New York City with a guy that I still sponsor. I've sponsored him for a long, long time. And the person, they were introducing themselves, and all of a sudden, this lady said, I'm an alcoholic and a druid. Now, druids are very big in the summer solstice. That's why NPR had them going ahead and, you know, they're all gathering at Stonehenge at a big meeting tonight. And I was just looking, I remember looking at Kevin saying, hey, what the hell, you know, no big deal, you know. You know, Kevin, the AA police wasn't going to jump down and throw him out of the meeting. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said, on the 4th of November, 1980. I was 36 years old. I had been drinking for 15 years. I did not start. I was not an infant alcoholic. I started my junior year in college. And the reason I did was because I saw alcoholism in my family. It ripped my family apart. We're from downtown Boston. I live on Beacon Street now, between Clarendon and Dartmouth. And I live about a mile from where I was born, at Cambridge City Hospital, right? But I've lived all over the world, too. But I'm happy where I am. But alcoholism was in my family. And I grew up in a very violent home. And at 10, 12 years old, you're not supposed to know how to call the cops. But I could. And it was alcoholism. But I didn't know what was going on. And I remember one time calling the cops and asking them to send a car. We lived in, out on the South Shore. And I said, send it to O'Donnell's house. And the cop said, which one? Because you could have picked up my uncle that night, too, on the other end of town, you know? Because alcoholism sometimes shows up in families. Anyway, I went, my father got sober out of the lock ward of the Brock NBA Hospital in 1955 or so, 56. And I watched the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous work. I watched the people in AA. I watched how they helped each other. And I saw a guy who had a lot of trouble and had a troubled life. I mean, these were two wars. You know, he was in Korea, he was in World War II. But that was no excuse. But I saw these people take care of each other and help each other. And they were my examples as I was growing up. And I knew one thing that was not good, and it was booze and my family. And we had a priest friend, Father Jim, he was from BC. He was sober in AA. And he was down at our house one Saturday morning. I was 15, 16 years old. I turned into a very, very good runner in Massachusetts. And way ahead of my time. And I was out for a run, I came back in. He was the only one in our kitchen, Father Jim. He was one of those typical Jesuits, you know, the wire-rimmed glasses and stuff like that. And he said to me, he put down his coffee and he said, Patrick, he says, I've known you since you were 10. And he says, I know your family history. I know your family. And I've watched your personality develop. And he put down the coffee and he said, you should never, ever, ever drink. He said, you are an accident waiting to happen. I said, that's a horrible thing to say, you know. But I didn't drink, okay. And I didn't pick up a drink until I was almost 21 years old. And I thought that I had gone through this stuff. I'd seen other people do it. I'd certainly had a nice life. I was in a nice Ivy League school. And I had stopped running my junior year, and I just figured I could settle down. I got back into my studies. I did a good job getting back into them. And then later on that year, I picked up my first drink, and I didn't get arrested. I didn't get thrown in jail. I didn't have a hangover. I didn't get sick. It was like, wow, I'm glad, you know. What's that phrase? I had arrived, you know. But over the next couple of years, drinking wove itself right into my life, very subtly. Cunning, baffling, and insidious, as they say. And sometimes even today. I'm 79. I turned 79 this week, I guess. The 19th, I guess, was yesterday. And I said to myself, how did I go through and not realize what this was doing to my life? How can I do this? You know, but it's just the way it is. It is cunning, baffling. And the other thing is alcoholism has a symptom that people don't recognize. It's denial. No matter what the hell happens to you, you're going to say, I'm not that bad. Or you're going to find somebody to blame for it. Or if you had my problems, you'd drink too. But if you drank like me, you'd have my problems. And that's what happened. I got out of the box real fast. My control went drinking. It worked for my father, with my father for a while in the early, I guess it was in the late 60s. And I went off to basic training in Fort Dix, New Jersey. It's a wonderful place. And while I was down there, I came home for Thanksgiving. This is important. My father was a bigwig in AA. He was all over the place. Well-known, very articulate, had good friends. And I came back at Thanksgiving, no hair. You know, they give you those 90-second haircuts and stuff like that. And my mother, who had a black belt in Al-Anon by that time, I think she started going when Lois developed it in 1952 or 1953. She wasn't taking anything. She was an Emmanuel girl. She was from over in Cambridge. And my mother was saying, you're not going to enough meetings, saying to this my old man. And I'm sitting there, 21 years old, 22. And I'm thinking, what a job this guy has done in his life, you know, from the Lark Ward to the Brockton Bay Hospital, he got a Lincoln outside and stuff like that. And my father said, there's more to life than going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mother spun on him like a cobra. And I don't know if it's an Al-Anon phrase, but she said, stinking thinking leads to drinking. I went back to Fort Dix. I got a call in January that year. He had picked up a drink. Now, did he plan on going ahead and picking up a drink? I don't know. Did the pressure he puts on himself too much? I don't know. The fact of the matter is, he picked up the drink. Nobody jumped on him. Nobody poured it down his throat. It was horrible. It was horrible. I'm the oldest of six kids. You know, my sisters are 10 years younger than me, 20 years younger than me. And it destroys the family. Did he think he was probably coming back? I think so. Because for the next 5 years, he bounced in and out, and in and out, and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he wasn't there by himself, because the family has to take steps to survive, and we had to cut him out of the family, and that's what happened. Because when you pick up a drink, if you're an alcoholic, and you've said you're an alcoholic, and everybody says, but you said you're one, there are consequences. Physical, mental, and legal. And he was out of it. That was it. I did call up a guy from Fort Dix. I called him from there, and I said, Frank Corbett, it's a friend of my father's. And he said, Frank, I said, what are you guys going to do about it? Because I didn't know anything. I had never been to AA. I'd only been drinking for about a year. And Frank said, we're not going to do anything, Pat. He knows where we are. We don't send out search parties. It's the hard truth. We're here to stay sober, not to recruit new members. We have to stay sober. The best example that you can give somebody that you have as a friend who's an alcoholic is for you to live sober and do the right thing. Don't beat them over the head with Paige Sunshine. That's not gonna do anything. They don't know how they're gonna get out of this trouble. Help them say, listen. So anyway, quick, he never got back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And he died a horrible death in 1973. He was murdered. Because of that's what happens. You end up hanging with people you shouldn't have been with, doing things you shouldn't have been doing. And the consequences sometimes can be heavy. But the sad thing was I never looked at my own drinking. By this time, I had gotten married. I was living up in Waterville Valley, New Hampshire. I had a nice business going. I was a very controlled drinker. Would never drink during the week. I wouldn't drink at lunchtime. I would drink on weekends. I was like one of those piano strings, I'm sure. Very regimented, and it was tough. And I had friends, guys that worked for me that I sent to Alcoholics Anonymous. I can remember Billy B, my plumber up there. I remember he was sober a number of years when I was up there, and he showed up. He had a slip after about 10 years, and I remember saying, Billy, you got to go back to those meetings. You got to go back. That's the only place. We can't even start from ground zero unless you go back to those meetings. He's sober, if he's still alive. I think he moved out west. But I couldn't look at myself. I didn't know myself. The next year, my brother Terry got arrested for drunk driving down in Scituate, Massachusetts, and took a swing at a cop that was trying to help him. And the chief of police I knew, and he called me up in New Hampshire. And he said, we got your brother Terry. And he took a swing at one of my guys. And you know, your mother's had some bad times over the last couple of months, last year. What do you think we should do? And see, we can see alcoholism in other people when they're having trouble. And I said, Walter, I think the kid has a problem with alcohol. Maybe you should keep him. And he did. He kept him in the jail in Scituate, Massachusetts on that Saturday night. And the next day, my brother used his phone call. And he called a guy, Joe D. And Joe D picked up my brother and brought him to the Snug Harbor Group in Quincy, Massachusetts, which is still meeting. And my brother Terry is coming up on 50 years of sobriety. He was 23. But Alcoholics Anonymous works under any and all conditions. There is no timeline when you can come in here. I have a friend of mine from Brookline, actually, in my old group, Nate. And Nate got sober. He, number one, he was Jewish. Number two, he was from Brookline. Number three, he was 86 years old. He was 91 years when he died sober. AA can work. Anyway, I looked the other way. I went through all kinds of things. Things happened. I got married. Had kids. I got divorced. My wife moved to the West Coast. She was no day at the beach either because we do not attract the willies. Sweet Marie, God bless her. She passed away a few years ago. But I just was running in circles, and I moved around a lot. I did geographical cures, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, all these places. Brought myself with me, came back to Boston to find my roots. And I came back to Boston, found a couple of projects. I've always been involved in construction and stuff like that. Had some good ones. I could put my act back together again where I wouldn't drink during the week, and I could pull these things off, and people say, how did he do that? And it was crazy. They didn't know what was going on in my mind. But God did, I guess. He had another plan for me. So I went through this for a couple of years, and I was trying to bop and weave and trying to drink wine only. You know, I was never a hard liquor drinker. I was a beer drinker and stuff like that. And my kids were out on the West Coast with my wife. We had no communication whatsoever. She was moving up and down. Now she's up in the upstate New York, upstate Washington. I didn't know what was going on. I was falling apart. I had to sleep. I had a drink to sleep. And it was a tragic thing. As I look back, I was very sad. My friend Peter got arrested for drunk driving in January of 1980. And he had to go to jail. He had to go to court. But Peter didn't have a problem with alcohol if you compared it to me. He was a bookie. That was before gambling was legal in Boston. Exactly. Brookline was a big headquarters for all of the stuff. They had Doc Sagansky. He was just a prince. He was a dentist turned bookie. He ran all of the business. They were all there. The North End was afraid of Doc Sagansky. They didn't come over here. He didn't go down there. But this friend of mine, Peter, he had his own business going. He was the bookie to the stars. But he got arrested. And he said, I think I'm going to AA. And I said, Peter, that's a good idea. If you're having a problem with alcohol, that is a place to take it. They are good people. Because what I remembered was the good people that I met, the people that helped my father, the people that helped my brother. But I wasn't that bad, because I had no arrests, I had no warrants, I was an under-the-radar type guy. And my friend Peter started to go, and I decided to control my drinking. So I spent most of 1980 drinking every other month. The first I didn't drink in February. I drank beer only in March. It was a bad experiment. By the end of March, I had to stop drinking again. I had to dry out again. I dried out. Said, I can't find a formula. It must not be in the beer. So I switched to wine. And Tall Ships were in Boston that year. And I drank so much rosé, I could speak Portuguese. it was disastrous. And my friend Peter was saying, is this the month you're drinking or one that you're not drinking? You know? Oh, crazy. Think of it now. And I say, what were you thinking? Anyway, that cycle continued. And November 1980, I went to a Harvard Brown game. I went to Brown. And we were over at Harvard. And I had this feeling that things with the wheels were coming off. I was with all of my friends, and their families were together, and there was one of them lives right across over here on Amory Street. He's a good friend of mine today. And he drank more than me in college. But he hasn't got a problem. Yeah. And it's amazing. I see him a couple of times a week. You know, it just didn't tag him. That's it. Tag, you're it. You have no choice on whether if you're an alcoholic. The only thing you can do is not drink. You know, you want to take that gamble? Take that gamble. That's what I tell my grandson. You know, take the gamble, kid. But anyway, Peter asked me if I'd like to go to a meeting, and I did, but I didn't want to. I didn't really think I was in it, but I had to check it out. And I went to my first meeting at BC High on a Friday night, and I went in there with a bunch of people, who were probably 200 people at BC High. I knew some of them because just from being around Boston and stuff like that, and they were all happy, and they were going. This one kid spoke. There were maybe it was an hour and a half meeting. There were four or five speakers, and I heard this guy, he said he was an alcoholic and he couldn't drink in safety. I don't know what they said the rest of that meeting. That's the only thing that went to my mind. That he was an alcoholic and they couldn't drink in safety. Not being able to drink in safety made sense to me, particularly after that last year of drinking every other month. It didn't make every difference. It was hard stuff, your stuff, my stuff, beer, stolen, on credit, didn't make any difference. In a bar, on the street, I'm allergic to alcohol. I can't drink in safety. I don't know what's going to happen when it comes into my system. But I do have a way of going ahead and helping myself. And that was by, I knew, by going to AA. But I still really didn't think I was an alcoholic. I wasn't in the VA wards like my old man. I wasn't in jail. I hadn't been arrested like Peter. And he said to me, he said, listen, why don't you take a good look at it? And he said, a lot of people, what they do is that they don't drink. And they go to meetings for a while. And they listen to people who know they're alcoholic talk about what it was like, how they got here, and what it was like since. And then you make up your own mind. He said, but remember, if you pick up a drink, that's an invisible shield, and the truth is going to bounce right off you. You don't drink and go to meetings and listen to these people. You might hear what's going to save your life. But if you don't, at least you're giving yourself a really good chance. And so I agreed to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic. I said, Peter, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. He said, if your life is better when you're not drinking, you're welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't give what you call yourself. If your life is better when you're not drinking, you're welcome here. We'll sort it out later. There's no photo ID card that comes with AA. You're just going, yeah, that's all. And I did a lot of yeah. In about 60 days, I told Peter, I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. He said, whoa, nice. He's going to a place called Littlest Bar on the Province. It was funny. It was funny. A whole bunch of us were getting sober at the same time. We were giving out chips by the end of a couple of years at that place in the morning. If you walked into that place between 5:30 and 8 o'clock in the morning, everybody in there was people in AA. Anyway, I said, will you be my sponsor? He said, no. You have to, I said. I heard these people. You got to. He said, no. He said, you get somebody with some time and grit, some experience and living sober. Don't get some 90-day wonder like yourself. Get somebody with some time and grade, just like in the service. And that's what I did. I got a guy, Bill B. Saved my life. Didn't know what to do, didn't know how to talk. Bill did the phones on Central Service every Tuesday night, and he says, hey, if you want to, come down. I'm answering the phones. We'll have time to talk while you're there. And that's what I did. I did the phones with Bill for 7 years after that, every Tuesday night. He was a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard about the steps. I said, everybody was going to the AWOL over at the Gavin House. I said, think I should do that? He said, I don't know, take a drag on a cigarette. He says, I never went through them. He says, I've been through the steps with my friends in 12 and 12 meetings and in my group. He was in a group, the Everybody's Group in Quincy. He says, if you don't like the way they do it over at the Gavin House, doesn't mean you have to drink. You just find another meeting to go through the steps with. There's many ways of doing it. He says, people have been doing it for, it was around 40-something years at the time. He said, just go along. That's what I did. I had some great people I ran into. My friend Ray Loomis, I ran into him my third day in Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened was, along with the committing to 90 meetings in 90 days, I was given a meeting list book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I call it the hard copy. We were joking about this, you know. Batteries never run out on this, okay? And you can look at it. It's a lot easier to look for what meetings are ever on a Wednesday here than it is on your goddamn phone. Well, you're probably going to be one of those people. I'm going to hit in my car because you're reading your phone while you're walking across the street. I'm of a different generation, believe me. So I had this, you know, I had the meeting list book, and I was on my way, you know, I was on my way. Bill was a great person for me, you know. With some other friends, I was in the New Commonwealth group when we started. I went through, I quit that group and I joined Everybody's Group in Quincy, you know, because New Commonwealth at the time, which was the biggest meeting in Boston, by the way, on Sunday night at 5 Commonwealth, wasn't meeting my needs, and I just didn't have to resign from the group or give a farewell speech. I just went to Everybody's Group in Quincy the next morning, and that was it, and I never went back. And that's what I did. That's how you change groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't give a shit why you don't like the group. And a couple of years later, my friend Peter and I and some others went ahead and started the Park Street group, which for many, many years was the largest meeting in downtown Boston. You know, 250 people every Thursday night, 5:30 to 6:30. You know, I get into the steps, like I said. I went in this AWOL group. We sat down. It was a small group, 15 guys going through the steps on a weekly basis, reading a step, talking about their experience, strength, and hope. We had a couple of guys who had been there. We had never been there. We had guys that were sober sometime. There were guys like myself who were brand new. I went ahead and I asked Bill, like, can I do my fifth step with you? He said, no. He said, get somebody you're not going to hold anything back on. He said, we suggest you try a priest. That's what they did back in 1980. They said, find a priest, somebody like that. A closed mouth friend is what it says in the book. You know, it says that in the book, a closed mouth friend. It doesn't say, get a sponsor to do your fifth step. It says, find somebody who's used to doing this, like a lawyer or a therapist or something like that. And I went to a priest up here. I'd never met him before. And I had a lot of stuff. And I laid it out to him. And I said, I didn't cover everything. He says, you got the rest of your life to cover it if you're going ahead and stay sober. He says, just do part two. And that's what I did, because the bad stuff was out. And the other stuff I could take care of with my friend Bill, my sponsor. And Bill knew that. See, he didn't want me to hold anything back. Those things that were waking me up at 3 o'clock in the morning, sober. How am I going to take care of that? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? It was crazy what was going on in my head. But I remember walking down from, I forget the name of the church, it's condos now. And saying, I don't know what the crisis is going to happen, but I'm going to be okay. And that was sometime in the spring of 1981. Now I'm going to tell you a miracle. Okay? I haven't heard from Sweet Lorraine for 5 years. I'm living in Boston. She's living someplace in Washington. I get a call from Sweet Lorraine. She says, you have two daughters, 9 and they're 7, and they'd like to know what their father is like. She had no idea I was sober. Nothing. No comment, no Christmas cards coming back and forth, no checks going back and forth either, by the way. That was another thing that was waking me up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we had a solution for that. We called it a lawyer, okay? And so anyway, she called us. She didn't know I was sober. And I went ahead and I said, I'll get right back to you. I talked to my sponsor, because he knew about this, of course, Bill. And he said, well, we'll take care of that. We talked about it and stuff like that. And those kids got off a plane about this time of 1981. And if you haven't seen kids during that time period, you don't even know what they sound like. Right? You don't know what they sound like. Because, like I said, there were no phone calls. There was nothing. They were living on a school bus on the side of a mountain in the state of Washington. They were going to a one-room schoolhouse. My daughter Caitlin's a doctor up in New Hampshire. Megan's down at Tabor Academy. They each have 3 kids. Their life is better because their father got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Eventually, they moved back this way because it was better for them, because what my kids needed was a sober father. That's what they needed. They didn't need bicycles. They got all that stuff anyway later on. But they needed a sober father. And that's what I got. And I got that from Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. The example works. Now, my kids don't have trouble with alcoholics. My grandkids don't have trouble. One's in playing baseball for some Brockton baseball team. Another one's in just ran in the Nationals at Franklin Field in Pennsylvania this weekend. These are good kids. They have a sober grandfather, and that was given to them because of Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother Terry's still sober. My brother Terry had kids. One of his kids got sober for a year and then shot up and died the next day after banging around AA for 10 years. Just because you know, it's what you do. It's not what my brother Terry did. You know, she knows. It's tough. And when you lose something like that, there's nothing you can do about it. You can just show up and be an AA friend. And you don't tell them what to do. You don't tell them what to do. you show them what you do. The best information I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got right in the beginning. I can't drink in safety. If your life is better when you're not drinking, you're welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. The third day I was in AA, I had heard, my father used to go to a place called the Sahara Club, which met at a little joint on Bromfield Street. And so my third day in AA, a Monday, I got sober on a Friday, I was at BC High. I looked in the back of the book, and they had the Sahara Club meeting. It was a luncheon, it wasn't a meeting. And I went down there, and I walked out, and I saw those people, like Father Jim, and my father's business partner, and all these other people. My father had been dead for years, but his friends from AA were still sitting there. And Ray Loomis came up to me and asked me, he said, how long have you been sober? And I looked at my watch. It was about 12:30 on a Monday, and I had stopped drinking probably around 12 o'clock the previous Friday. And I said, 3 days, I'm not new. And he said, you got a meeting this book, he said that. And I said, yeah. He said, you have friends in AA? I said, yeah. He says, you know where some meetings are? Yeah. He says, you know where we are? I said, yeah. He says, well, you just keep on staying sober, doing what you're doing. You go with these people, and this is where it counts on you. You are these people. He says, you go with these people, you do what they do, and you're going to be okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat.